Accession number 27344, Reel 11.
Candlelight, Reel
11. Well, after the Turpitz attacks, we'd carried on for a couple of months going up the Norwegian coast with the Murmansk convoys and doing anti-submarine patrols, and just the aim being to keep the submarines submerged so that they had to go at their submerged speed rather than their surface speed. And even if they were getting reports of positions of the convoy, we were hoping that we would make sure they couldn't get themselves to a position where they could intercept. But of course, they were very experienced, and they were positioning their submarines sort of from North Cape in a sort of semicircle to the west of North Cape, just to make sure that they were going to intercept the convoy somewhere. So it was a matter of flying ahead of and to the side of the convoys, just trying to make sure that the submarines would see us even if we didn't see them, and they would stay submerged and would be less able to manoeuvre to get to an intercept position. So we did that for a couple of months. Very boring, I'm afraid, it really was, but I think as far as the convoys were concerned, quite essential.
Was there ever an occasion you saw a German submarine?
I never saw a German submarine, ever. After that, we were moved away from there, and the squadron was sent to Beccles in Suffolk. Now, in Beccles, we were required to do night flying up and down the Dutch and Belgian coasts and round as far as the German coasts, to try and make sure the Germans weren't moving shipping up and down that coast at night, and also trying, if possible, to intercept E-boats which might be out looking for our shipping. The advantage of the... you could actually see the E-boats because they're quite fast vessels, excuse me, and they usually moved in groups of four. So you could see four wakes. And their engines were very noisy, and they couldn't always hear our engines. So sometimes it was possible to intercept a group of four and perhaps get a chance to drop bombs across them in the hope that you might hit them, but it was very hit and miss, so I don't know if we ever succeeded. But I do know one of our chaps did intercept a ship and bombed it, but unfortunately it was a British ship. It's unfortunate because we weren't warned that there was British ships in the area.
I mean, it was very difficult at that time of the war to actually identify German shipping because, well, you know, we're talking at the tail end of 1944.
Well, at night you weren't identifying anything. You were just, again, seeing a wake. We did have the very, very primitive radar called ASV, anti-shipping, whatever a V stood for. And this could pick out a ship if the sea was flat calm and everything was in our favour. You could get a blip and perhaps home in on it. The thing is that we had two great... you know these aerials that you see on top of a house with the little antennae sticking out the side? Well, we had two huge ones of these, one on each wingtip. And this was directing the radar beams that we were searching with. The trouble was that if there was any sea at all, if the waves were higher than, oh, say, 18 inches, we started to get reflections from the waves. And you just got nothing but a screen of white. And if you could pick out a ship from that, you were very clever. We never did. Anyway, it was the first development of anti-shipping radar, and I suppose from it they got sufficient information to be able to go on and develop things into a better level.
Who would operate the radar?
The observer, always. So he had his head in the radar, and he would give us a course to steer, and then we would fly that course. The trouble was that we couldn't always do wind finding. Even using a flame float wasn't always successful. So we were dependent on the wind we were given by the Met Office ashore being reasonably accurate. And I suppose most times they were. But if they were inaccurate, you could find yourself very close to the shore, because we were aiming to go up and down perhaps between 5 and 10 miles offshore was what we were aiming to search. And if the wind was wrong, you could find yourself less than 5 miles and even getting closer. And some of the harbours, like Den Helder, was very, very well defended. And you could give yourself a big fright if you found yourself close to Den Helder accidentally. But some of the other harbours up and down were well defended as well. But it was just a matter of flying up and down and, again, discouraging them from sending ships round the coast by night because they knew we were there. I don't know whether they did it or not, but we saw very few, very few. Anyway, we were flying from Beccles. Now, this was a town in Suffolk, and on the Suffolk coast there was a belt called the Diver's Gun Belt, which was about half a mile wide on the coast of Suffolk, from Suffolk right down to Essex. Mac may have gone down into Essex as well. Now, this was a belt of land where they had anti-aircraft guns by the hundred. They really did. And in the Diver's Gun Belt, they didn't care who it was that was flying. They fired at it. They didn't wait to find out if it was friend or foe. If there's an aircraft coming in from the east, they fired at it. And, of course, we were coming back from the east at night. So we had to try to make sure we didn't end up in the Diver's Gun Belt.
Was this the gun belt that was developed for the V-1?
Yes, absolutely. And it was a bit frightening because once or twice people made mistakes because the wind they'd been given wasn't good enough. And the strength of the anti-aircraft firepower was very frightening indeed. So they decided to move us from Beccles in Suffolk to Norfolk, to Langham in Norfolk. So we were moved north of the Diver's Gun Belt. And Langham at that time was the CO, was a group captain called Clouston, Group Captain Clouston. And he was a real devil. He really was. One of his claims to fame was that he used to test balloon barrages by flying into the cables to see what happened. And he lived to tell the tale. That's the sort of man he was. Anyway, we were flying from Langham on the night that this other ship was bombed, and as soon as the air gunner wireless back by WT that we had attacked the vessel and gave a position, I had been flying earlier and come back and debriefed and gone to bed. And I was asleep, and my steward rushed in and said, "Come on, you've got to go out again." So we got off. I got up and got into our flying gear and off down to the briefing room. And when we were all mustered in the briefing room, the group captain came in, told us what had happened, and said to the CO, he said, "Fill them up with rum, send them out again." So anyway, we were all sent out again, but unfortunately none of us found anything.
What was the kind of duration of these patrols that you were
doing? Oh, 2.5 hours, I suppose. I can't find one. 2 hours 55, 2 hours 35. So 2.5 hours ish.
And would it normally be just one operation a night you would do?
Yes. We would fly off at intervals of, shall we say, quarter of an hour. And you're all going off as individual aircraft. And as far as we were concerned, we were trying to maintain one or two or three aircraft over the area throughout the night. and we had 18 aircraft, so nobody needed to fly more than once.
It's quite interesting with the patrols as well. It seemed by this stage of the war how important it was, the element of dissuading enemy action, almost as much as sinking an enemy, in a sense. That
absolutely. That's absolutely true. And you'll find when you talk to those who were operating in the North Atlantic how important they found it. And it was still there that it was confirmed that this was the way they were saving lives.
Because it's a role that's not often known about, not only the North Atlantic, but also the patrols off the enemy.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Well, I don't know how long they'd been going on before or after us, but we were there... We were there until the end of December, 44. So that was, I suppose, 2 months that we were doing that operation. So I don't know who took over from us or who was there before us.
And were you operating under... You said the commander of the airfield. Was it an RAF airfield?
Oh, yes. It was RAF command, RAF airfield. We were just the guys going to do the flying. We got on very well with them. Tremendous rivalry between us, of course. But it was a friendly rivalry. And we enjoyed our time there immensely. One of the things was that we were able to play quite a lot of sports, and we played hockey, rugby and football. And with a squadron of 18 aircraft and the number of men in it, we could put out one of each, a football team, a rugby team and a hockey team at the same time. So we made sure that we all got plenty of sports activity in as well. And then, of course, when the evening entertainment of the local dancers and that sort of thing came along, we were along there with the RAF.
And the Benzedrine.
Yeah, it was a waste of time, it really was. But anyway, from Langham, we went off... where did we go to? Oh, yeah, we went to Macrahanish. Now, Macrahanish was a naval air station at the south end of the Mullican Tower. And it really was out in the wilds. If you wanted to go to Macrahanish by road, it was a 12-hour journey, because you had to go right round through the Trossachs and then right back down. So flying across from what is now Glasgow Airport, used to be called Abbots Inch, flying across from there to Macrahanish for naval people was quite a regular practice. And because we were three-seater aircraft, we were quite often used to carry senior officers backwards and forwards. But bearing in mind that between the Mullican Tower and Abbots Inch is the Isle of Mull, and it's quite high. And the weather on the west coast of Scotland in the winter was often very, very poor visibility. So you just learned how to get yourself from A to B, because there was still no ground control radio approach. So you had to be very careful what you're doing when you were going back to Macrahanish. But going in from Macrahanish to Abbots Inch was interesting as well. And what we used to do was to fly over and aim to join the coast somewhere near Prestwick, because we knew there were no mountains there. So we'd fly over until we joined the coast and then turn north and follow the east coast of the Firth of Clyde up round the corner to where the Clyde goes in towards Glasgow. And you just keep following it around, and then the first river on the right, you turned right, and you were in the circuit to land at Abbots Inch.
Seems to me very much that you were learning these skills of flying in low visibility using landmarks.
Oh, absolutely.
Quite an exceptional level.
Oh, absolutely, and it's something that modern pilots have not got used to at all. And I don't know if you heard, just as a breaking away entirely from the situation, at the RAE exhibition at Farnborough this year, they had one of these gigantic American aircraft coming over to do a flypast. Now, he came over from somewhere in the Midwest and flew over to fly over Farnborough and fly back again. Now, I don't know how much it cost the American Air Force to do this, but it must have been thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. Anyway, this was the plan. And they flew over, and they came down low level, and he came across, and he found an airfield, and he said, "There's nobody here." He was looking at Blackbush, and he couldn't tell the difference, simply because he just didn't do that sort of fly. So he flew over, flew around Blackbush, and flew back again. That was this year. Anyway, I'm just saying the modern pilots are not as used to flying by landmarks as we were. It was our normal practice because we didn't stop flying because the weather was bad, unless it was so bad you couldn't see the wingtips.
I was going to say, did you get used to flying in bad weather?
Yes. It was always, shall we say, exhilarating, but you did get used to it.
You wouldn't, because it must be quite, you mentioned one of your first few flights when you flew in bad weather and it was quite difficult.
Yes.
But you can come to an accommodation with that in your own mind, can you?
Oh, absolutely, because you know you did it all right last time. And so long as you are clear in your mind what you're going to do, as I said, flying into the west coast of Scotland, we'd aim for Prestwick, knowing that there were no hills there. So that you could fly over the coast and know it wasn't a cliff.
Would it be a problem if you became disorientated and you didn't know where you were? Would that be much more? That would
be a major problem. That would be really a major problem because you would be in a situation where either you were going to try to force on or you were going to try to go back. And going back to Macrahanish was a sight more dangerous than trying to go on to Prestwick.
I mean, what options would you have should you find yourself in low cloud and you had no idea where you were?
Well, you were very poorly placed because if you didn't have an air gunner, he wouldn't be able to give any WT signals. And even if he did, they couldn't give you a fix on the WT signals because they weren't geared up to do it. I suppose you would fly around until you ran out of fuel and then ditch.
Would you descend out of low cloud or would that be...
Very dicey. If you were in cloud, I think you would bail out if you wanted to stay alive, certainly flying around Scotland. If I was flying anywhere near Macrahanish in cloud, I would certainly be above 3,500 feet. And getting down from that would have been, in those days, an impossibility. So it would have been a matter of bailing out and hoping that you didn't land far out at sea.
And would there have been any facility to pick you up there? Would you have to radio your last location?
Well, no radio. The radio was very primitive. It was the WT, it was the main method of keeping in contact. The radio, you'd go out of radio contact, you'd enough radio contact to speak to the control tower from a range of perhaps up to 30, 40 miles. But not much more. But they couldn't get you down anyway. You'd just say, "I'm in trouble."
And I take it that would have been affected anyway by the terrain anyway, wouldn't it?
Could be. If you were behind the mountain, they perhaps wouldn't hear you at all. No, it was definitely dicey. Can we stop there?
So what type of other duties were you doing at Macrahanish?
Well, we were at Macrahanish basically because we were waiting for one of the new carriers to come into action. They were building light fleet carriers. Now, these are compared with the fleet carriers like the Indomitable, Indefatigable, Formidable, Victorious, Eagle. They were all really big, heavy ships. And they had decided that they could have more aircraft at sea with the lighter fleet carriers, and the first group were going to be Colossus, Vengeance, Venerable and Glory. And we were due to join Colossus. So we were at Macrahanish waiting for Colossus to do her trials up and down the Clyde. And then there was some sort of a hiccup, and we were sent from Macrahanish to a small RAF station on the west coast of Ireland, on the west coast of the Down Peninsula, called Ballyhalbert. And that, quite honestly, was the most primitive air station I've ever been at. It was midwinter, and we were in Nissen huts, and the heating in Nissen huts was one stove in the middle of the hut, and you were rationed with the amount of coal that you could use. And it really was bitterly cold, and we did not enjoy Ballyhalbert at all. But luckily, we were only there for between 10 days and a fortnight, very short spell. And then the ship was ready to receive us. So what we did was we flew out from Ballyhalbert and did deck landing practice for us to get into practice again. And, of course, we had a lot of new pilots because we were going out to the Far East and the squadron had been built up in size quite considerably. So a lot of pilots had joined us from training and they hadn't got any operational experience in carriers, so they needed to be brought up to speed, as it were. So we were going flying out, all doing deck landings, and then flying back to Ballyhalbert. And this, of course, was an advantage to the ship, that they could get in the amount of practice they needed with aircraft without having the bother of doing maintenance and all that sort of jazz as well. It was purely flight deck activities. And once we'd all done day flying from the ship, they decided they wanted to see what the ship was like for night flying. So four of us were detailed to go out to the ship to let them practice night flying as they were going up and down the Clyde. So the intention was that the four of us would take off in sequence, fly around and land on. And to begin with, they had the deck lighting at full brilliance. And that was the first landing. Then when we came round for the second landing, they had the deck lighting at half brilliance, and then down to quarter brilliance. In the last landing, there was no white lights at all. There were just the blue lights round the edge of the deck, which you couldn't see from the air anyway. And the only indication you had that there was a ship there was the fact you could see the wake. And came round to land on using the wake to judge where you turned in and started your descent. And on the back end of the carrier, the batsman was standing with three lights, one in each hand and one on his chest. And in the same way as he had signalled to you during the day using the fluorescent bats, he used the same signals at night. So you flew round and came in on the approach with him and his three lights standing there. And it worked very well. It's surprising how you could come round on the wake, judging your turn in, and then just as you got aft of the carrier, perhaps 100 yards or so aft of the carrier, just about to land on, then you could see the blue outline lights. And then you would just touch down, catch a wire, and then taxi forward of the barrier. And that was exciting, I tell you, bloody exciting. But there were no incidents. We all did it absolutely safely and surely. And then we flew back to Ballyhalbert. And that was the last activity before we joined the ship to go out to the Far East. So we then joined Colossus and she set off for the Mediterranean. And we were going to do a workup for the ship in the Mediterranean, and we were doing it at the east end of the Mediterranean, and the air base that we were using was a place called Decela, which was in Egypt, not very far west of Alexandria. In fact, within easy driving distance of Alexandria, and we could have runs ashore into Alexandria, but there were always ructions. There really were. Because the Egyptians weren't very fond of us. And once we realised how much they disliked us, we started playing up as well. And flying, we were very, very naughty. We really were. We used to fly low level through the fishing fleet and try and blow them over. Sometimes it would work. So naturally, they weren't very pleased with us. And the other thing was that if they were driving their goats or camels out through the desert, they used to go low flying over them and scatter the flock. We really were bloody naughty. The things we used to do to them.
What would they do to you, though?
Oh, they'd beat the sailors up ashore and that sort of thing. They would gang up on them ashore, and of course then the sailors would go ashore in groups as well, and there were fights and troubles very, very frequently. But I think it got to the stage where the sailors rather looked forward to it. But anyway, we weren't there all that long. But
was there any problems actually operating in that kind of deserty, sandy environment, though?
Oh, yes, because we used to get occasional sandstorms blowing across. And although the aircraft engines were, the air was filtered going into the engines, I don't think it could always cope with the amount of sand involved. And there certainly were maintenance difficulties when we were ashore at Dekela. But then we would go off to sea again and we'd be practicing from the Colossus. And we were waiting there, basically, for the Vengeance, Venerable and Glory to come and join us, because we were going to be the aircraft carrier Group 11 and we were aiming to operate as a group when we got out to the Far East. So we used to just do exercises, dive bombing exercises, navigation exercises, all that sort of stuff, just keeping ourselves up to scratch. And there was one occasion when we were flying from the ship and I was detailed to lead a group of six aircraft to go off and do a dive bombing exercise on a towed target. Now, this is a target towed by our own ship, and it was probably about a mile astern of the ship. And we were just required to go around and do practice dive bombing on it. And they would watch from the ship and try to make a reasonable estimate of where the bombs fell compared with the towed target. The towed target used to throw up a plume of spray so that they could see it clearly and we could see it clearly. And we always dived across the line of advance of the ship so that, generally speaking, in dive bombing, errors tended to be in the line of flight. You'd either throw the bomb too far or drop it short. You didn't very often drop it far left or right. So if you imagine a fall of shot of a group of aircraft, it would be a long, narrow pattern with most of the bombs being almost on the line of attack. So we used to attack across the line of towing. So anyone in the ship knew how far the target was from the back end of the ship. So by measuring the angle, they could see how far it was in yards from the target. So we used to get a reasonable estimate. Anyway, we had, all six of us had dropped eight bombs each. And then we were off probably 2 or 3 miles on the beam of the carrier, intending to join up round a flame float. And I was there first, and I was sort of flying around, watching when the others were going to come and join me. And I looked out to my right-hand side, and there was an aircraft formating on me. And he should have been number three, line astern of me. So I signalled to him, go line astern, and then started looking over my left shoulder again to see where the rest of the aircraft were. And then I had the most frightening bang, and my aircraft was nearly out of control. And I didn't know what had happened. But my observer said that the aircraft which had been on our right-hand side had actually flown into us. And his tail unit struck my starboard wing. And it had knocked the flap loose, and it was just flying around, flapping against the side of the aircraft. And there was a fair-sized hole into the rear, the trailing edge of the main plane. And we discovered afterwards that the hole came as far forward as the main spar, and in fact it had dented the tubes controlling the ailerons. So another inch or two and the ailerons would have jammed and I wouldn't have had any control at all. But anyway, I got control of the aircraft again, and the observer said that two aircraft had crashed and nobody had got out. So that was six people who died. And I flew back. Do you want to stop?